yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Today we're going to talk about another movement, the labor movement. And why is it in such a crisis? And what's wrong with its strategy? Why won't it lead all the rest of the progressive movements here? I mean, certainly the conditions exist, don't they? Well, we're going to talk about that. My guests today are Steve Irby, a very well-known longtime unionist at various levels in the labor movement, trade union movement, and an author now of books on the trade union movement. Another one that is forthcoming very shortly, I believe in about another month. Steve, would you just give us the name of that, your new book?
Yes. Monthly Review Press is bringing out a new collection of reporting and essays. It's called Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. You can order it now at the Monthly Review Press website, and copies will be available in a couple of weeks.
Well, it certainly sounds timely, and it certainly is appropriate for this show, Save Our Unions. As some listeners may know, unions in the private sector now represent fewer than 7% of workers in this country. That's down from about 22% when Reagan came into office. And in some sectors, some industry sectors, like manufacturing and construction and so forth, the numbers back 30 years ago were well over 60-70% in some cases. Okay, so the private sector union movement has almost disappeared in this country, and the question we need to ask ourselves, will it survive by the end of this decade? Kind of a provocative question, but, you know, we need to ask questions like that when the membership declines to less than 7%. Of course, public sector unions are more percentage represented, but they're under severe attack as well, and the Republican governors seem to have the momentum in rolling back in their states, a couple dozen, public sector unionization, pretty much eliminating the union shop and passing right-to-work legislation, and increasing initiatives on the part of conservative governors who are winning, it seems to me. There's a few occasional successes by labor, like in Chicago teacher strike, but by and large, they're kind of catching labor off guard. Michigan, places like that, used to be strongholds of American labor and public sector unions as well. And they're fighting back, but they seem, governors seem to be winning this struggle. And the question is, will the public sector unions follow the trend in the private sector, a trend that points to a decline? You know, another sign of severe challenge here is the fact that last year, organized labor lost 500,000 members when the economy created more than a million jobs. Well, okay, let's admit it. Most of those jobs are low-paid service jobs, part-time temp jobs, contingent jobs, as they call it, and low-paid. But still, that's the first time labor's lost that many members while the labor market has been growing, albeit slowly and weakly, but nonetheless, they've added jobs, and labor's losing by huge amounts. What's going on? And it's not just the numbers. It's density, as they say. Labor does not have concentration in certain areas as it once had. And that's reflected in collective bargaining getting weaker. The other side of the coin of union decline is the decline of collective bargaining. And we want to talk about that. You know, why are unions in free fall? And what basic strategy change is needed for labor if it's going to reverse this free fall? And strategy not only in terms of political strategies, which don't seem to be working very much in the last 8-12 years, although labor has pumped hundreds of billions of dollars into the Democratic Party. It's got virtually nothing to show for it. You would think if a company invests hundreds of billions of dollars and it gets no returns, it changes its strategy. Has a total revamp and relook at where it's doing business and moves on and changes it. Well, labor doesn't seem to be doing that, pumping more and more money into the Democratic Party. They take the money and they do what they want anyway. So the political strategy seems to be a total bust, but also I would add that the industrial strategy, in other words, the strategy every day vis-a-vis management and corporations, is now in turmoil. You know, for about 20 years now, the core of this industrial bargaining strategy has been what's called maintenance of benefits, MOB for short. MOB meant, okay, we'll give up wage increases in bargaining as long as we can maintain our health care and pensions coverage, which for unions has always been much better for non-union workers. And so have the wages, for that matter, but that wage differential, the union, non-union wage differential, is shrinking. But to get back to MOB, that's been the strategy for over 20 years now, but it's in tatters. As we see, cost of health care continues to rise, and solutions to it are becoming more and more pro-business. I wouldn't call it solutions, you know. During Clinton, what did we have? We had what's called managed health care, which was just a euphemism for let's make the patients pay and ration their own health care. Let's continue raising the prices, and they'll just keep buying less. The coverage will decline, and the cost sharing and premiums and deductibles and copays will increase. That's managed health care. That's Bill Clinton's solution. Then we get George W. Bush, and what's his solution? Health savings accounts, which really privatized the whole thing. Privatized meaning, okay, folks, go out and buy your own. Yeah, you got a lot of bargaining power, one individual against these big mega health insurance corporations. They write the price. You can take it or leave it. Health savings accounts was the solution there. And now we got Obamacare, which is just another version of privatization. Go out and buy your own insurance, right? Oh, the government will subsidize you. We'll take money from union health care plans, negotiated plans in the middle class and the middle and upper tiers of the working class, and we'll give it to the working poor. That's what Obamacare is all about. And by the way, we'll pass it through the insurance companies, and they'll skim off a huge amount of excess rentier profits in the process. So, you know, Obamacare is nothing but a health insurance company subsidization bill. And we're going to move the money around. Anyone who's been in the unions and bargained knows what that's about, moving the money around. Management says, hey, look, you know, this is all we're going to give you. You can move it from here to there. We don't care where you put it, but that's the cost. That's all we're going to give you. Well, Obamacare is moving the money around between different sectors of the working class. Middle class is funding the working poor, and the health care insurance companies are skimming off the lion's share in the process. Okay, that's privatization. And what? That means the end of union-negotiated health plans by 2018. 40% tax on union plans means that's the end of the union plans, and the process of dismantling has already begun as corporations and management now have got an upper hand, and they're pushing this thing. and taking more and more away. No way, we're going to pay 40%, they say. So, okay, unions have to give up even some of their health care coverage now, just like they gave up wages. So this whole idea of focusing on management of benefits, MOB, is coming to an end, and it hasn't produced any long-term successes. We've given up wages and for health care, and now the health care is going to be taken away from unions and union bargaining and their members. At the same time, of course, they're attacking Medicare. So, you know, that's their next target. Anyway, my view is that both the industrial strategy based on MOB and the political strategy based on SOB, i.e. the Democratic Party, is at a total dead end. What strategy for labor, then, is the question. Steve, you heard my rant. What's your view of this? What's wrong with labor strategy? And not just, you know, the political side of this strategy, but also the industrial side. I'd like you to comment on it. I'm sure you wrote about it at length in your book. And do we have our other guest on yet, Aaron?
Yep, I'm here, Jack.
Okay, Aaron, good, good. We want you to elaborate on your view on this topic as well. So, Steve,
well,
you wrote your book coming out. What's your comment?
I would start with what unions have done right and what some of the challenges that they face now in pursuing the one strategy in the private sector that has helped them boost their membership over the last 10 or 15 years, and that's the strategy known as bargain to organize, where major unions exert pressure on unionized companies or partially unionized companies that they have bargaining relationships with or influence over in some way, to persuade them to permit non-union workers that they employ to sign up, become union members, organize, and get the protection of union contracts without management interfering. As you know, and as I'm sure your listeners know, that when private sector unions help workers form a union in non-union workplaces and management actively interferes, fires union activists, makes threats, intimidation, very, very difficult for unions to win contested National Labor Relations Board elections. So this alternative strategy of pressuring employers to agree to not oppose unionization, to recognize new union bargaining units just based on employees, a majority of them, signing union membership cards rather than having to go through the second step of a labor board election, has enabled hundreds of thousands of workers at major companies to organize in recent years who, under other circumstances, different, less favorable ground rules, probably would not have been able to organize and gain contract protection on that scale. And the examples I'm talking about are my own union, the communication workers at AT&T Mobility, where 35,000 wireless workers have been able to unionize through this so-called card check and neutrality agreement approach. The hotel workers have organized thousands of new members in the Hilton hotel chain. The Teamsters were able to organize a big new bargaining unit of truck drivers and warehouse workers at United Parcel Services Freight Division. And the healthcare unions, the service employees and the California nurses, have been able to organize in recent years in the South. Always difficult terrain for union organize. These two unions have organized 10 to 20,000 new members in Texas and Florida at facilities operated by the Hospital Corporation of America. So, again, it's not all doom and gloom. There is a strategy here that's worked when unions have stuck to it, pursued it aggressively, mobilized their members to support it. It faces a very serious legal challenge at the moment, a case that was argued just a week or so ago at the Supreme Court that we could talk about. And the strategy has encountered some difficulties on other fronts as well. But I would argue that in the private sector, unions still have a lot of clout in certain industries and with certain employers, and they're underutilizing it, and they still need to bargain to organize where they can.
Well, you got some number of, in the past year, as labor lost 500,000 members last year, how many did it add through this bargain to organize strategy?
Oh, I would say that the membership losses that have been replaced have been a fraction of the union job losses. No, by no means is it compensating for the overall deunionization trend.
Are we talking about last year thousands or tens of thousands or what?
I would say
any rough estimate.
The most recent large-scale success involved the HCA, the Hospital Corporation of America campaign, in the South. That was now 2 to 3 years ago. They've negotiated first contracts. That involved 10 to 20,000 workers in all. No, we're talking thousands, not 10 to thousands. And the reason really is what you indicated earlier. The bargaining climate has become much more difficult. Employers, major private sector employers, have come to the table with demands for givebacks, and they're much less willing to agree to union proposals that are going to make it easier for non-union workers that they employ to come under the protection of collective bargaining agreements. I mean, these bargain-to-organize agreements, the best of them, were only won after many years of struggle. They require membership education, mobilization, and struggle, sometimes strike activity. So when unions are thrown into a defensive posture, focusing mainly on trying to hold on to wage and benefit conditions, very important for their existing members, they're less apt to go on the offensive at the bargaining table and win the kind of contract language that will make organizing the unorganized easier.
We know management doesn't give up anything for nothing. So what has been the trade-off here? I mean, to get management to agree to allow other unorganized segments of their company, and we're really talking about large companies here, right? I mean, the smaller companies, medium-sized companies don't play this game. It's only the very, very large companies, you know, like AT&T maybe and so forth, HCA. What's the give back? What's the trade-off here?
I think you're getting to the heart of the current legal controversy over the strategy, but to back up a bit, in the CWA industry example, the current agreement that has enabled tens of thousands of AT&T mobility workers to organize required originally a 5-year campaign of battering the predecessor company of AT&T, Southwestern Bell, in the regulatory arena, in state legislatures throughout the Southwest. Basically, the union took the position that if the company was going to engage in union-busting activity in its new wireless subsidiary when wireless started to replace landline phone service, the union was going to become a formidable adversary in every legislative, political, and regulatory arena where the company's interests were at stake. So the union opposed rate increases. The union intervened to put pressure on the company in a number of ways and finally brought management to the table and got them to agree incrementally to an organizing rights agreement that gave union organizers access to non-union workplaces, gave them lists of employees, involved a pledge that management and its supervisors would not campaign against unionization, and eventually eliminated the need for representation elections. The company agreed to recognize union bargaining units based on a majority of workers signing cards. You know, the downside of this approach involving some unions is that other sorts of trade-offs have been made, and at this point they seem to be getting us into a little bit of legal trouble. Some unions, for example, have agreed in advance of workers actually choosing to be union represented, have agreed to the contract terms that they're going to be covered by. Some unions have agreed not to picket or boycott or strike for subsequent contract gains in return for the upfront employer promise of access and an easier path to unionization. So you're absolutely right. Some of the trade-offs that unions have gotten involved in to expand their membership through this bargained organized strategy have compromised unions in some industries and made them less effective as representatives of newly organized workers. The theory, of course, is that if you can get your foot in the door, if workers can at least win the initial right to bargain and a first contract, they can build on that later on, if they have sufficient union support for doing so and the union hasn't signed away its ability to back them up.
Sounds to me, though, that that strategy works for only a very small niche of organized labor. In other words, large companies that may be involved with services that aren't highly offshoreable and perhaps, you know, are more service-oriented and therefore not so much displaceable by new technology. You know, if you look at most of the collapse of union labor in the last decade, it's because of those two forces. One, offshoring, significant offshoring of jobs, and for the jobs that aren't offshore, replacing labor with new technology and capital investment. And most of the big corporations that aren't service related are doing just that, and you're not going to negotiate any of these deals with you know, the likes of U.S. Steel and Aluminum Corporation America and so forth, but you may do it with service companies, you know, like the phone companies, AT&T, and perhaps you know, hospitals and so forth. But it doesn't sound to me like that's any solution in a broad sense, in a general sense, for the what is this, you know, rapid decline of both the membership and the effectiveness of bargaining for union labor in this country. Aaron, you know, what's your comment on that?
Well, I think there are, you know, many issues at play. You know, certainly one of the things that labor can be doing and should be doing is it's not mobilizing its own membership. You have something like 17 million union members still in this country, and these members really are not mobilized because most unions are a little bit more than benefits and grievance corporations. Also, unions do not have any sort of real plan to retain members that it loses in any capacity. You know, there's a lot of talk about alt-labor, worker centers, opening up unions to new forms of membership, but it doesn't do a very good job of retaining or acting in the interest of all those millions, perhaps tens of millions of workers who used to be union members at one point or another. Certainly also the relationship to the Democratic Party is highly problematic. Obviously, organized labor needs friends on the inside, but it's become little more than an ATM for the Democratic Party. And you're right that it gets basically what it gets in return is the Democratic Party establishment says we're not going to kick you in the teeth quite as hard as the Republicans will. But I think in a lot of ways, these questions, the bigger questions are more a question of the failure of the left. And that's what's really missing is a mass left, that unions come out of the working class, but they can't really be understood, I think, as class organizations, ones that create and nurture class consciousness. That historically is the role of the left. And that's what's really missing, where you have all sorts of other working class institutions, social institutions, cultural institutions to create that consciousness throughout society. I think one development that points to this that was quite interesting is and it's small, but it's still telling, is the election of Shama Savant, the socialist, to the Seattle City Council. One of her first actions as as an electee was she went to meet with the Boeing workers. And she told the cheering crowd that if Boeing decides to leave town, that you guys take over the factory. You take over the equipment. That, you know, you're the ones who know how to run it. The executives don't know how to run it. And she said to him at one point, the workers have more power than they think. So many of these questions, especially in the reporting I've been doing across the country with various labor struggles, it's perception is fundamentally important. What people think they can do. I don't think the bottom 80% of Americans need to be told that things are hard, difficult, or extremely tenuous. It's just that people have very little hope about acting collectively. I've talked to Walmart workers across the country. Doing a research project, I talked to 11 different Walmart workers. Every single one of them was pro-union. Yet the level of fear is so great, and of course this is a fear that is produced in every arena by the media, by politicians, by corporations. The fear is so great that they don't think it's worth taking a risk to try and form a union that will inevitably be crushed. So I really think, you know, a lot of these questions actually get back to bigger historical and social forces related to the decimation of the left.
Well, you know, let me just interject at this point and reiterate. Wages have been declining for most production and service employees, i.e. all working class employees. Maintenance of benefits is under great attack at all levels. I mean, we didn't even mention pensions being rolled back. And what's going on with Obamacare now, and, it's a time bomb in the middle of Obamacare to destroy union-negotiated health plans. By the way, the unions actually went to Obama and said, hey, can you adjust this? And he told them, take a hike. And I know the Teamsters went to Obama and said, hey, wait a minute, we and restaurant workers and so forth, are still making very low pay. Shouldn't they be eligible for the subsidies, under Obamacare? And he says, no, go away. So, it's just slap in the face, one after another. I mean, forget the card check thing of the last 6 years, where Obama did absolutely nothing, even when he had strong majorities in both houses of Congress, still would not bring it forth. We can look at this thing from the perspective of decline in membership, but I don't think that's, the correct way of looking at it solely. You got to look at why is collective bargaining proving to be a failure. I mean, I'm not arguing against collective bargaining, but it's just not producing the results. And even the area that it did for a while, benefits, that's under extreme attack and doesn't look like it's going to prevail for the next decade. The bargaining, the whole industrial strategy seems to be not producing results. And as I said before, you would think people would say, okay, let's do something else. This isn't working. But it doesn't seem to be much of a, at least in the senior levels of the AFL-CIO and Change the Wind, that doesn't seem to be much real effort to really reevaluate the industrial strategy and let alone the political strategy. I mean, I remember 20 years ago when they fought against NAFTA, the unions, and when they fought against free trade, but right now they seem to be kind of rolling over on this Trans-Pacific Partnership. Yeah, they talk about it, but there's no real mobilizing effort going on. Most of the effort against the Trans-Pacific free trade on steroids deal is coming from outside the labor movement. What does this all mean in terms of strategy? What needs to be changed is the question. Fundamentally, not tweaking here or there, but the whole general political strategy and the whole general industrial strategy doesn't seem to be producing results. Okay, we need to take a little break here. But I want us, Steve and Aaron, when we come back, I want you to comment on, you know, what strategic changes do you think labor needs to make? And I don't mean tweaking. I mean, what significantly needs to be done, because this is not a, a situation where small adjustments are going to make much difference, it seems. Okay, this is Alternative Visions, and we'll be back in a moment with our guest. This is Jack Lesmus, your host of Alternative Visions, my guest Steve Early and Arun Gupta, and we're talking about the American labor movement, the trade union movement, which in times past, decades past, used to lead social struggles, and of course, in recent decades, last several decades, that leadership role has pretty much declined, and we see other groups in society seeming to be at the leading edge, and labor is way behind. All right, we're talking about what's wrong with labor strategy, organized labor strategy, both at the political level and, for lack of a better term, at the industrial level, the level where, you know, unions and their members confront management. And, you know, my proposition was that both strategies are proving to be increasingly ineffective, and therefore something needs to change. So what is it, and how should it change, is the question of the day, both at the political level. How does the union movement extricate itself from this total reliance on the Democratic Party? How does it move towards more independent political action? What's the strategy for that? What are the tactical moves that may implement that strategy, and not necessarily a total break, maybe, but a shift, and not a total reliance on the Democratic Party. And then, of course, at the industrial level, how does labor develop more clout when it comes to bargaining? And what's it going to do with the decline of maintenance of benefit bargaining if it can't negotiate wages and it can't negotiate maintain health care, because the legal challenges are overwhelming the bargained relationships? What's the future for collective bargaining? Is it just tweaking minor stuff? I agree with Arun, you know, that there's, and I'm sure Steve agrees, that there's, it's not, the problem is not a lack of workers in this country wanting unions. It's overwhelming. All the surveys are overwhelming. They want unions, but they can't seem to get them. Is that because management's too powerful and politicians are backing management up, or is it because labor doesn't have the right strategy as well, or a little bit of both? Anyway, Steve, address this question. Does labor need more independent political action, or is labor's political strategy too dependent on the Democratic Party? And if so, how does it move towards more independent political action?
I would agree it's much too dependent on the Democratic Party. It's a dysfunctional relationship. It's self-defeating, and it needs to change. I devoted a great deal of space in this new book, Save Our Unions, to the experience of progressives in the great state of Vermont over the last 30 or 35 years who have probably made more progress than any group on the left anywhere in the country, weaning union members away. And it wasn't easy, and it didn't happen overnight, but weaning them away from the Democratic Party and Democratic candidates. And I think the experience of independent progressive party building in Vermont, progressive candidacies, should really be studied, because I think, you know, in some larger scale and more urbanized environments, I think they could be replicated. I think the success of a socialist candidate in Seattle City Council is one example of that. In Vermont, you know, the door was opened 35 years ago by Bernie Sanders' election as mayor of the largest city. Bernie went on to run as an independent and a socialist as mayor four times. He became a U.S. congressman, and now he's a U.S. senator. That created the political space over time for the Vermont Progressive Party to emerge. This is the most successful third party in the country. It has eight representatives in the state legislature. It has folks on the city council in Burlington, on elected bodies throughout the state. And you can see what having a pressure group, a viable third party to the left of the Democrat Party, can do in Vermont, because it's the only state on track, not as fast as people would like, but still on track to create a state-level single-payer health care program that would go beyond the mess of Obamacare. So I think the Vermont experience is worth looking at. It's really been a great laboratory for progressive politics, and a key element of the Vermont Progressive Party strategy, and certainly Bernie's success over the years, has been concentrating on labor causes, on working class issues, on economic issues that the Democrats are never going to fervently champion. And more and more union members have been voting for independent candidates, sometimes despite the official endorsements of their unions, who have continued to remain in the corner of the Democrats.
Arun, would you pick up that that topic, and what's your view?
Yeah, certainly. I think the organized labor has just a deadly dependency upon the Democratic Party, and this is something certainly that goes back many decades. You know, even in histories of the 1930s, there's definitely an infatuation with the labor leaders with being close to power, that there's a kind of sociological phenomena, you know, that happens when labor leaders enter the halls of power, that they think, you know, this gives them prestige, and they've become very much accustomed to it, that, you know, their argument constantly is, as well, at least we have a seat at the table. But ultimately, they need to, you know, that's one of the fundamental issues. They need to break from the Democratic Party. But again, they're not going to do this by themselves, right? This is like asking the U.S. Congress to impose strict campaign finance reform. It's never going to cut the base of its own personal power off.
Arun, if I may interrupt, that means, are you saying that this break, whatever that means, has to occur at the local union level by local union leaders and activists? Is that the direction?
It does have to come from the grassroots. Now, you know, I think you're aware that I did this big report on the Service Employees International Union Fight for 15 campaign, looking exactly at the origins of it, you know, which it runs contrary to a lot of the media reports, what their strategy is, what they're trying to do. And one of the interesting things that I found across the country, and which I actually didn't have space to talk about in the report, is there's a lot of kind of maneuvering going on over who is really in control of the campaign. SEIU is pursuing a very top-down strategy. You know, but it's not a union movement, but for, you know, lack of a better term, let's just say the rank and file. The workers who are in these chapters across the country, where you find the agitation for worker-led control, for worker-led decision-making, and this is what's causing SEIU headaches, it's where you have the left that is active, where you have people who are involved in anarchist organization and socialist organizations, people who are coming out of the Occupy Wall Street movement. But at the same time, SEIU is dependent upon these activists, and in a number of instances is even recruiting them to join the campaign, because often they're the most energetic and dynamic organizers, but they're the ones who also hold SEIU's feet to the fire and are demanding that this be a movement really in the interest of the workers and not something that is just going to burnish the tarnished reputation of SEIU.
But you seem to be making the argument, if I can paraphrase you, that there has to be some alternative organizational existing pole for people to
make the break
and engage in independent political action. In other words, there must be something there for people to move to. You just can't say, well, let's break from the Democratic Party. Workers being very pragmatic, practical, are going to say, well, what does that mean? What's the alternative? I don't see anything else out there. So am I correct that you're arguing that these independent polls have to be created before you can have more independent political action?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to think much more broadly in social terms. You know, I think there's often, you know, in discussions about organized labor, there's a conflation of the working class with unions. The working class is far more than unions, and you need to have all sorts of other organizations. You know, if any type of discussion of what is really going on with the labor movement over the last 30 years, you know, it's always in reference to the 1930s, right? Because that is when organized labor changed things dramatically. But what was dramatic, the conditions, though, you had this widespread working class consciousness and institutions. You had dense working class neighborhoods and cultures. You had popular ideas, you know, that workers were in war with the bosses, that workers were the ones who created wealth, that they were the ones who had should be making decisions. You had a different worldview, and that's why the class consciousness is so fundamentally important. If you don't have that, what you have is essentially collaborationism. You know, where the unions are trying to figure out how can we collaborate with the corporations in a mutually beneficial way such that we can increase their business, their corporate control of the economy, of society, such that we can get a bit more wages, a bit more benefits from our members. That becomes your best case scenario.
If I can interject here and play devil's advocate, you know, we hear people in the labor movement and outside the labor movement saying there should be more independent political action. Yeah, the Democratic Party has taken labor and workers, for granted, and they're not doing anything, and so on and so forth. But what I don't hear on the left, or people who claim they're on the left, is that, okay, how are you going to do this? You know, there's a lot of discussion of what's wrong, but there's very little discussion on the left of, well, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to do about it? You know, if you're going to say break from the Democratic Party, you should be saying, well, what's the strategy? Meaning, how is that going to occur? Organizational programs, so on and so forth. And what are the tactics for doing this? The left does not think in those kind of details. As far as I can see, in most cases, and those are the details that are critical when you want to talk to workers, because they're not going to jump from the frying pan into the fire. How are you going to do this? What's your proposals concretely for, as Steve indicated? How did they actually do it in Vermont, and why is it only in Vermont? Did Bernie Sanders strike a deal with the Democrats? Okay, let me play socialist in Vermont, and I won't upset and spread this movement elsewhere. I don't know. Steve, what do you think of that?
Well, I don't know. The Burlington Free Press, the Bernie's hometown paper, did an interview with him a week ago in which he was making surprising noises about possibly running for president as an independent candidate in 2016. If we're confronted with the usual dreary Tweedledee, Tweedledum choices, you know, whether this would be kind of a replay of the Nader campaign in 2000, which I supported personally, but certainly didn't command broad support from unions other than the California Nurses and the United Electrical Workers, you know, I think there's
there'd be a lot of enthusiasm on the left and among progressives initially for any Bernie run, because he would be the only candidate in the race making an issue of free trade and sticking up for workers' rights and talking about corporate power and embracing the demands of Occupy Wall Street, demanding that something be done about the crisis of global warming, and so on down the list. The practical considerations, which he discussed in the interview, which I suggest people access, involve any independent getting on the ballot in 50 states, a major hurdle that Ralph faced when he ran in 2000. Anyway, I think it's important that somebody with the base and the stature and the nationwide network and following that he's developed over the years at least is rattling a few sabers. Otherwise, we're faced with the dreary prospect of Hillary Clinton being our progressive standard bearer against some Republican who will be marginally worse. But, I think what makes Bernie's pronouncement about considering a run kind of interesting is that, at least in Vermont, it's been tied to some local party building and some long-term grassroots organizing. Just running a presidential candidate every 4 years certainly has not contributed as much as we would hope to building of a third-party movement. So I think, to go back to what I said earlier, it has to start at the bottom. It has to start with people running for school board, participating in town meetings and venues like that, supporting labor struggles, linking workers, the environmental movement, student causes, housing issues, low-income issues, under the broader, electoral banner of campaigns like the one that was just conducted successfully in Seattle for the city council, where the socialist alternative candidate was very involved in Occupy Wall Street there and other local struggles, the Fight for 15, and took them into the arena of electoral politics in a way that was quite unconventional and should be much less so.
But can you do it with just individual actions, people running, like this person up in Seattle here and there? Because we're talking about independent political action and getting organized labor to move in the direction of independent political action.
I think Sawant did a good job, and of course she had a strong organization. She had socialist alternative folks that I know from all around the country coming to help her out, but mainly she had built a base from her previous campaign for public office in Seattle, and she did a pretty good job of splitting the labor boat, going to the Central Labor Council, getting individual union endorsements, and really contesting for organized labor's support. And but you don't do that just coming out of the blue. You got to lay the groundwork. You got to be, in some cases, hopefully, a union activist yourself, but certainly someone that's been on the front lines of union struggles and causes locally and nationally, so that your bid for official endorsements and, better yet, union funding and union volunteers making phone calls and knocking on doors for you and coming to rallies is based on increased level of consciousness about the need for political representatives that we can count on are not going to let us down, as the Democrats so often do, who are generally a disappointment waiting to happen.
Well, okay, so we have the example of Seattle as the possible strategic model. We have the example of the Progressive Party in Vermont, that's just in Vermont, hasn't expanded beyond or tried to expand beyond as a model. We have Bernie Sanders running for president will light some fires and lead to some organizational development that eventually can pull labor more into an independent political action. I don't know, but I mean,
but we also have
I don't have the strategy myself, but it seems to me that the kind of ad hoc, activity here and there is not a strategy. Something more structured is necessary if you really want people in large numbers to move towards an alternative, an independent alternative. But let's move to the industrial side. You know, I'd like your comments on the industrial strategy of labor right now. You know, I've been arguing devil's advocate here that both the MOB and of course the wage side of this are proving increasingly ineffective, and we're in a retreat on both fronts, which seems to me that collective bargaining industrial strategy is in as much a crisis as the political strategy of labor. What's your comment on that, Arun?
Well, I think the whole NLRB process is completely broken, right? You know, I was covering a steelworkers strike, a very small strike last year outside of Youngstown, Ohio, which of course has a fabled history of labor activism. And, you know, if a worker gets fired for protected union activity, it can take many months, in possibly even years, to get a favorable ruling from the NLRB. But if a corporation files for an injunction against pickets, it can often get it the very same day. And so,
is that collective bargaining strategy, though? NLRB?
Well, it's part of the whole NLRB process, right? You know, it's how it handcuffs unions. So you have, by one estimate, something like 50,000 workers a year are fired for protected union activity. So it is essentially become de facto legal to go after anyone engaged in a union campaign. And this is the context for any sort of collective bargaining. If you can't even wage a struggle, right, you know, labor has become very selective in how it picks its fight. You know, we go back, you can look at the statistics from the 60s and 70s where it was being much more, much bolder in terms of where it was trying to organize, and it was also had a tolerance for a higher failure rate. Now it's become so difficult that it has to be extremely selective before it goes in. Even then it wins less than half of the campaigns, and even when it wins the campaigns, I think something like only in, it's either 40 or 60% of the cases, it gets a contract. And when you keep parsing it, basically it comes down to it that only in something like about 12% of cases does the union exist and still have a collective bargaining agreement 5 years later. So if that's the type of odds that unions are up against, they're basically in a state where they cannot reproduce themselves. I mean, I think, you know, one of the biggest issues is the decimation of worker education by unions, that they don't they no longer engage in any sort of real worker education. To them, worker education means educating the workers about contracts. So, you know, I think there's a whole context to the collective bargaining that we have to understand that makes it.
So you would say we need NLRB reform first if we want to revitalize collective bargaining, so forth. Steve, we only have a few minutes left. I'd like you to take a shot at the question. How do we defend and revitalize maintenance of benefit bargaining, which has been the core the last couple of decades, in view of the attack on union-negotiated health and pension plans, Obamacare, you know, dismantling of defined benefit pensions and so forth? How do we revitalize the industrial strategy?
Well, again, this is messy. It's inadequate. It's not a grand strategy, but I think it's a starting point. You know, people with collective bargaining rights are better off than those, you know, the 90% of the workforce that doesn't have them. It's certainly not the golden era of bargaining. A lot of unions are taking backward steps. But every contract negotiation, every collective bargaining struggle with an employer is an opportunity for what Arun was talking about, membership education, mobilization, politicization of the struggle, and particularly in these defensive fights about benefits, tying a defense of decent job-based health coverage, even though that's a system that needs to be replaced, and decent retirement coverage to the need of the 90% who don't have bargaining rights for universal health care and improved pension coverage as well. I mean, I just think unions have to kind of broaden their appeal. Otherwise, their strikes, their contract fights, their defensive battles are not going to resonate with the broader working class. We have some examples of unions doing a good job of framing the issues so that they do get broader popular support. And I think there's a lot of room for improvement in that area. But if you approach bargaining in traditional fashion, keep the members out of the loop, much less keep the public uninformed about what you're doing and what stake they might have in the outcome, then you're really setting yourself up for defeat and failure.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for your views and your perspectives on this very important topic, I think, increasingly as we go forward here in the coming years, on how does labor reverse the decline, both reverse its failed political strategy and failing industrial strategy. We didn't have a chance to talk about the connection. Maybe the solution is, instead of a national approach, focusing on the best possibility in certain state levels and bringing in non-labor allies to focus and concentrate the pressure. I don't know. Just a thought. We're going to continue this discussion next week with some other representatives here from labor as well, and maybe we can get a broader discussion going. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, your host, Alternative Visions, and thanks to Steve and Arun.
Thank you, Jack.